From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Nelson Peary grew up black and poor during the Depression. He didn't want to surrender to the demoralization that was stifling everyone he knew. As a young man, he left home and became a hobo. He saw America by hopping freights. During World War II, he enlisted in the segregated army so he could fight for justice, even though, as a black man, that was something he didn't have in his own country. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Peary about his new memoir, Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. Peary began his book almost 50 years ago, when he was 24. A portrait of Nelson Peary coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide is calling for swift and definitive action by the international community to oust the Haitian military rulers. But he says he's constitutionally barred from calling personally for military action. President Clinton has said that military action is an option for throwing out the Haitian military leaders. Meanwhile, the White House says between 8 and 12 countries would join the United States in forming a multilateral force for Haiti. They would act only after the Haitian leaders leave. A White House spokeswoman says the force would train the new Haitian military and police forces. It would also make sure there isn't an outbreak of violence. The White House won't say which countries are committed to this force. A Navy lieutenant who acknowledged his homosexuality on a national television broadcast has been recommended for discharge from the service. A three-member Navy board says statements by Lieutenant Tracy Thorne violates the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
Lieutenant Thorne revealed his sexual orientation in May of 1992. The Navy Board of Inquiry found that Thorne's statement raised the presumption that Thorne engaged in homosexual acts. Under the don't ask, don't tell policy, Thorne could have attempted to rebut that presumption, but chose not to. During his hearing, Thorne said, "In reality, there is nothing for me to rebut. I have made no statements about conduct. I have made statements about who I am. I'm an American, a naval officer, and a gay man." The Navy Board's decision will be reviewed by the Secretary of the Navy, who will have the final say. Thorne's attorneys will appeal any discharge in federal court. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
A strike by Soo Line Railroad Company employees is slowing down service for commuters across the Midwest. Annalise Hensel of member station WUWM reports from Milwaukee.
The first pickets went up in Milwaukee last night after 3 days of last-minute contract talks collapsed between the United Transportation Union and the CP Rail System, which runs the Soo Line. CP management has taken over the duties of union employees, and that's forced a slowdown of service. Amtrak, which operates on tracks owned by Soo, has had to reduce its daily trips between Milwaukee and Chicago from 7 to 4. Commuters are also being told 40 extra minutes will be tacked on to the hour-and-a-half-long trip. The strike of 1,100 employees from the nation's ninth-largest railroad company is also expected to slow down Amtrak passenger service from Minneapolis to Chicago and to affect freight delivery throughout the Midwest. For National Public Radio, I'm Annalise Hensel in Milwaukee.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 36.5 points at 3,740. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up 4.5 points at 723. This is NPR. A government health care panel has released guidelines for treating a common ear illness found in children 3 and younger. Vicky Quay reports.
Inflammation of the middle ear, or otitis media, is a leading reason why children see a doctor. The Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research released guidelines for treating one form of the disease, otitis media with effusion. This condition causes fluid in the middle ears, but no fever or pain. Doctors usually treat the problem with antibiotics and sometimes drain the ear by inserting tiny tubes. While the agency found antibiotics help some children get better faster, officials said most will get better without any treatment. Some experts, however, criticize the recommendations for saying antibiotics have any value for this condition. They say doctors are overusing antibiotics, which carry the risk of causing allergic reactions and creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria. In Washington, I'm Vicky Quay.
There are questions being raised over whether some of the flooded lands in the South ought to be farmed. Kenneth Cook is president of the Environmental Working Group. He often criticizes U.S. farm policy. He says there are areas of the country where the staple crop is disaster assistance. He says three of Georgia's counties in the flood area are among the top 50 in the nation for regular claims against the federal crop insurance program. Congress is looking into the matter. A Senate panel will take up a White House recommendation next week to possibly relocate people out of river lowlands. Lawmakers are also considering requiring farmers to buy catastrophic insurance. Previously, if farmers didn't buy it, the government took care of the bill. Italian authorities say at least 27 elderly people died today when their retirement home collapsed in an explosion. Investigators say the blast was caused by a gas leak. The single-story concrete building crumpled into rubble and crushed many of the people. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nelson Peary experienced a kind of American life that no longer exists. During part of the Depression, he was a hobo. During World War II, he served in the all-black 93rd Infantry Division of the Segregated Army. He writes about these parts of his life in his new memoir, Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. After the war, Peary made his living as a bricklayer and worked for several left-wing groups, fighting racism and other forms of injustice. For most of his childhood, he lived with his family in a small, rural Minnesota town called Wabashaw. His family was the only black family in town. Here's the story of how they wound up there.
My father, at the end of the war, he wanted to become a lawyer. Now, actually, there weren't many black lawyers in 1918, and he had a hard time doing it. Of course, he was from a working-class family in St. Joe, Missouri. And he tried to do this by going to school at night, but he got married and had a couple kids, and so he took a civil service examination for the mail service, which at that time was the cream of the mail service, that is the railway mail service. And he passed the examination, and him and another veteran were the first blacks to be accepted in the railway mail service. And the supervisor in St. Joe, Missouri, was absolutely furious about this, and he would not work. He would not have a black man working in the mail in the railway mail service under him. So he was transferred to Minneapolis. We moved up there in 1928, and then my father immediately clashed with the supervisors over racial discrimination. Clashed with the supervisors in Minneapolis, and they transferred us to this little town, Wabasha, which is about 80 miles south of Minneapolis. And this was a town where most of the residents had never seen a black before. I think it's necessary to also understand that at that time, the divisions between blacks and whites, in the North especially, was very, very complete. There was real walls between them. There were no communications or no nothing. So they were very, very surprised when we moved in, and a whole new section of my life began. At that point, I was about 7 years old.
Tell us just a little bit about what it was like to be the only black family in a small town where they hadn't seen blacks before.
Well, I think the first thing that has to be said is that people are people and kids are kids. And I was about seven at that time. And our main interest was having fun, you know, playing baseball and throwing rocks and going hunting and so forth and so on. And being the only black family, we weren't a threat to anybody. And so basically speaking, at that age especially, we just got along fine with everybody. There was fights. There was name-calling and this sort of thing. And we got into fights. And after the fight was over, shook hands and continued on what you were doing. By and large, I would say that the period I spent in Wabasha was a very basically a happy time. And it was fundamentally a schoolroom for me for the way I would approach human beings for the rest of my life.
Your father wanted to move to a bigger place. He wanted to move to Minneapolis. So he
right.
requested a transfer. And I love the letter that you quote. It's he said in this letter requesting a transfer that his sons were reaching puberty and they were beginning to associate with white girls. And he was sure that the postmaster general was as opposed to this as he was. What a strange way to have to ask for a transfer.
Well, because he'd ask for a transfer every year. And it was never even considered. That letter actually went to President Roosevelt.
Really?
And the Postmaster General, of course, stopped it and immediately agreed to the transfer.
Is this because they were so concerned, too, about him having sons who were associated with white girls?
Absolutely. At that period of time, that was where the line was drawn. And, of course, they understood. I think everybody understood you couldn't put seven black youngsters in an all-white town without them ending up having white girlfriends. I mean, there were no other women available, right? So that was something that they simply would not tolerate. So we got that transfer out of Wabasha immediately.
Actually, your father was very worried about one of you ending up like the Scottsboro boys, unjustly accused of rape of a white girl.
Yes, that was always a fear. You didn't have to do anything in America to be lynched or to be beaten up or sent to prison. You didn't have to be guilty of anything. It's all you had to be is black. And he was very afraid of this isolation. He was also afraid that sooner or later, some of his boys were going to get involved with these white girls, and their parents might object to it, and then there was going to be problems. As matters stood, no one ever objected to anything, but there was always that threat hanging over us.
So what was the most striking change for you going from a small town to Minneapolis?
Well, I think for the first time I was thrown in with a group of black kids my own age who spoke differently and to some degree thought differently than I did. That, you know, when I met them, to shake hands and say hi there, you know, it was something kind of strange to them. I know we were called hayseeds from the minute that we moved to Minneapolis, that we were looked upon as being very strange young people. But we fit in very quickly and very quickly, you know, found our place in the corner grouping, what we called gangs, you know, which we didn't do anything more than stand around and talk with each other. But we fit in very quickly, I think. I don't think there's any real transitional problems, although there was certain changes that me and my brothers had to make in order to completely fit in.
Like
I mean, we had to learn different ways of expressing ourselves. We had to learn. We had to gain different objectives, so to speak, and cultural objectives. We had to learn to like different kind of music. We had to learn to dance and so forth and so on, something I never did, incidentally.
You probably had to learn to stop saying hi there also.
Yeah, huh? We had to stop saying hi.
The year before you graduated high school, you jumped a boxcar and became a hobo for a while. And you write that you really needed to get away. What was behind that urge?
Well, the first part of it was, I think, that there was such a terrible contradiction between the life I had lived up until I was about 15 and the life I lived between 15 and 17. And that is to say, at my earlier stage of development there in Wabasha, I always took it for granted that sky was the limit, that if I did well in school and if I kept my, so to speak, kept my nose clean and obeyed the law and was a decent human being, that I would be able to go as far as I wanted to go. It became painfully clear by the time I was 17 years old that the mop and the cleaning the toilets and carrying the coal and these menial tasks was about as far as any of us were going to get. That it was not only was there a depression going on, but the racial barriers were very, very strict at that time. And there were very few of the blacks that were able to get past those barriers. Now, there some did. But most of them that did so because they had very powerful white friends.
Did the hobo's life seem like a good alternative to you?
No, but it's one of those things that once you get started, you can't hardly extract yourself from it. That the hobo's life is a terrible life. It's dangerous, it's dirty and filthy, it's full of hunger and self-doubt and so forth and so on. It's a terrible life, but at the same time, you're free. Right. If you don't like where you're at, grab a hold of a freight train and go someplace else. And that kind of freedom, I think, gets into the blood of people. And once they get addicted to that kind of a life, they simply can't stop it because they can't knuckle in and knuckle under to authority anymore. But it was a very great experience for me because, again, I learned more of my own people by being a hobo. I learned more of America, her beauty, her viciousness, her kindness. I learned a whole different America than what I had known before.
There had been a hobo jungle near your home in Wabasha.
Yes.
What did you see of hobos from living near the hobo jungle?
Well, to me, they were always a fascinating group of men. We got to kind of realize that the destitute of that year, of that period of time, were a bit different from what you see today, that there was always a hope that they were going to get a job somewhere else, something that kept their human spirit alive. You see amongst the homeless today a certain grinding down and destroying of the human spirit because of the hopelessness of their situation. But everybody felt that somehow or another, around the curve, over the hill, they were going to be able to get a job, and they were going to be able to come out of this kind of a life. But the hobos to us as youngsters were just fascinating. I mean, they were from the farms, they were from the city, they played guitars, they were able to, you know, do lariat tricks. It was a fascinating thing. Just a whole new world was available by that freight train.
One of the hobos put a large E on the side of your house. What did the E mean?
Well, we never really decided. It meant either eats or easy, one or the other. But at any rate, every hobo that came through that area came to our house for something to eat. And of course, at that period of time, especially the kind of a person my mother was, that no one was ever turned away from our home.
So the E was a sign that your house was a place you could stop.
It was the first place they hit, incidentally, after they got off the freight train. That would be the first house that they got to in Wabasha there. And the word got around, you know, that they were assured of something to eat. Maybe not as much as they would like, but they were always welcome at that house.
Did you find homes like yours when you were a hobo?
Yes, I did. I remember getting into Butte, Montana, to Helena, Montana, which was not a very hospitable place at that time. And I, at that time, been reduced absolutely to destitution. I was absolutely broke. Winter was coming on. I didn't have any warm clothing. And I'd never done this before, but I went to this woman and home, knocked on the back door and asked this lady if I could do some work for something to eat. And this woman broke out crying. Of course, I was just barely 18 at that time. And she broke out crying and gave me her husband's overcoat and fed me and then prayed with me. And I don't think you'd find that today. I don't think you'd find knocking on the door of a strange person and they would treat you in that manner. There was a whole different psychology in America at that time.
My guest is Nelson Peary, and he's written a memoir called Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
Okay, this is Fresh Air. Nelson Peary is my guest, and we're talking about the subject of his new memoir, which is his early life. The book is called Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. For our listeners who haven't heard the expression hobo jungle, explain what it means.
Well, a hobo jungle was the name that the non-hobos gave to it. They called it a jungle. To the hobos, it was home. The real jungle, it seems to us, was outside of that area. That the real jungle was where the police beat you up, where people threw stones at you, where you were unwelcome, where people talk about they're going to put you on the chain gang if you hang around this town. That was the real jungle. We didn't name the hobo jungle the jungle. For us, it was home.
You say that these places where the hobos lived, I guess near the railroad tracks, they were usually kept pretty clean. Who kept them clean?
Well, we did. I mean, first of all, nobody wants to live in a dirty place. That's the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And the second place was that you couldn't really live, you couldn't exist if there was a lot of trash and dangers of fire and all this kind of business. You know? So consequently, when you came into one of these jungles, you found it relatively clean and you left it relatively clean. Again, I want to say there was a different psychology back in that period of time where people felt that they more or less belonged to wherever they were. And if you were in a jungle, you kind of felt you belonged to it. I've seen many, many times on the road where other hobos had left pots of food, had left pots of coffee for the next person that come along, you know, could get something to eat or drink. And you don't find this today. You don't find this feeling of solidarity, this feeling of unity. And that didn't happen automatically, incidentally. That was a result of, years of real privation and real destruction of the economic structure. After all, we're talking here about 1939, 1938 period.
What were the vagrancy laws like back then, and what did you need to know in order to not get arrested?
Well, first of all, practically all vagrancy laws stated that you had to have $10 or else you were a vagrant. You had to have $10 or a job or else you were a vagrant. And so every hobo learned that when he got down to his last $10, he was broke, that he didn't spend that money. Now, some of them, of course, had to, and a good number of them went to jail, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days for vagrancy. And incidentally, you know, these laws are still on the books in most places. But today they don't arrest people for vagrancy because there's absolutely no jobs for them to take. But there, the vagrancy laws, at that time, the vagrancy laws had as their purpose to constantly lower the wages, the going rate of wages, by putting pressure on everybody who didn't have a job to take any job at any price. So the situation in that respect has somewhat changed, but it was a vicious law. And it wasn't just men that went to jail on the vagrancy laws. Women, children, anybody who didn't have the $10 or a job, they were a visible means of support. Then they were on their way to jail.
Were you ever arrested for vagrancy?
I was arrested. I was only arrested once in this respect, and that was under a law they call sleeping. That is to say that you couldn't sleep on public property or private property, that you had to sleep on your own property. And I was caught asleep in a railroad yard in North Dakota, at Mobridge, North Dakota. And I was given 3 days, which wasn't too bad. And I served that 3 days, and I learned that I could not go to sleep on railroad property. I could not go to sleep in a park. I could not go to sleep on anybody else's private property without permission. In other words, it was a very dangerous period of time to grow up in.
Well, there must have been places where there was no place to sleep.
That's exactly what it was. There was no place to sleep. So you hid out like an animal. You found some place that looked safe, and you curled up and tried to get a few hours sleep. One thing that characterized being on the road, being a hobo, was that you were absolutely exhausted all the time. You never got a night's sleep.
One of the things you did to make a little bit of money, you took some work at a farm picking peas, but you kept ending up more in debt instead of making any money. Now, how does that happen?
Well, first of all, when they got you onto these big farms that you didn't realize, or at least in the beginning, I didn't realize that I had to pay for the shack that we slept in.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pay exorbitant prices for bread, for slices of old bologna, or whatever I took from them, with the exception of water. I had to pay for a bologna sandwich that cost the employer maybe 4 or 5 cents. Cost us 25 cents, and that was over an hour's wage. And so you never got ahead. I mean, you had to be a really experienced farm worker in order to make any money over and above your living expenses. And this was true of all kinds of migrant work, not just work in the fields, but other kinds of migrant work were subjected to this kind of thing, too, that these agents of the employers that picked up the hobos and bought them to these various places to work, they made their money by ripping them off in every possible sense of the word.
Now, of course, you couldn't leave until you were even, and it was hard to break even because you were always in debt.
That's right. And when you did go into debt, you generally speaking went into a compound that had barbed wire and dogs. Wow. You couldn't get out.
So how did you finally get out?
Well, you know,
place?
With me, I kept going further and further into debt, or actually what I was doing was about breaking even, but not making enough money to get out of there. And two Japanese young women who were very experienced farm workers gave me a bushel basket of peas, which meant 50 cents, and so that I could get out of there, because both of them understood very well how desperately I wanted to get away from there, and that I just wasn't a pea picker. I didn't know how to do it. And I've always been very deeply indebted to these two young women for handing me over their hard-earned bushel of peas so that I could escape from that semi-slavery of that camp.
Was it physically difficult to hop a train?
Yes, it is. I mean, but most of all, you have to get some sense. You have to learn how to. You have to learn what trains to hop and how to hop them. That it can be very dangerous, and as you can imagine, that hobos were from time to time getting killed by falling between boxcars and being crushed or whatever. But if we were careful, and careful meant, generally speaking, if possible, to get on a train while it was standing still, and if you had to catch it on the run, to know enough not to catch, for example, not to catch the car at the end, because if anything happens, you'd swing between the two cars. So to catch the car at the front of the car. So if something happened, you'd be slammed against the boxcar and just drop to the ground. Little things like that you had to learn in order to be halfway secure in that kind of a life. And there was a lot you had to learn to stay alive there.
What are some of the surprises that awaited you when you actually got into a boxcar?
First of all, I think that not everybody in a boxcar is your friend. I mean, it was on the move that robbing the hobos took place. Like, for example, at the end of a harvest, when the men and women got into these cars, boxcars going to another locale to continue their farm work, they generally had a little bit of money. And that was the time when people robbed them. That was a place where all kinds of bad things could happen. But at the other hand, that was also a place where people shared their cigarettes or shared their tobacco, you know, where they told jokes and laughed and talked about home and so forth. That it was, the whole hobo life was one of contradictions, of freedom and slavery together, of laughter and fear together. And it was a very, very difficult way of living. And yet, as I had said before, that it was a life that people became addicted to. Because you didn't have to knuckle under to anybody there. It was a certain freedom that I had never known before or have never known since.
How long did you lead a hobo's life, and why did you decide to go home?
Only about 9 months, actually. Not even quite that long. I'd say about 8.5 months. And the reason I went home was that one of the hobos murdered a detective. And the two men who were involved in this happened to have been my friends. And one of them was caught. The man who'd murdered the hobo, or the detective, the railroad detective, was caught and just plain beaten to death. And his friend got away. And I finally ran into him down into California. And he was almost dead at that time too. He was an older man, and he talked to me for a minute and convinced me that I had to get off the road now. I could not stay on it and expect to get off it later on. That I'd been on long enough that I was going to become addicted to it, and I said, get off the road, go home, go back to school, and try to make something out of myself in the sense of the word of helping our people, as he told me, that you've learned the score now, and our people need young men who know the score, so go home. So I did. But I was very restless after I got home. I never fit into the kind of a life that I was forced to lead from then on.
Well, when you got home, I think you were 18, and you tucked your way back into school so you could finish your senior year and graduate high school.
Yes.
It must have been very difficult to adjust.
It was. It was. First of all, I lost a semester of school, and I felt much older and much coarser, much rougher, and much wiser than these young men and women that was now in my graduating class. I did have a very difficult time adjusting to them.
Nelson Peery is the author of the memoir Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Peery will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, serving in the all-black 93rd Infantry Division of the Segregated Army during World War II. Some black soldiers rioted in protest against the conditions black troops were subjected to. Nelson Peary enlisted to save freedom abroad, but the military made it very clear how little freedom blacks had at home. Part two of our interview with Nelson Peary coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Debate continues over a possible U.S. military intervention in Haiti while several hundred Marines rehearsed an evacuation of American citizens from the island nation today, NPR's Suni Khaled reports.
Georgia Senator Sam Nunn said the White House should think through an invasion of Haiti very carefully and urged the Clinton administration to reevaluate its economic sanctions policy. Nunn, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, called for sanctions that truly target Haiti's military rulers and their supporters, and not broad moves that have increased the suffering of poor Haitians. While not ruling out his support of U.S. military action in Haiti, Nunn said that such a mission should be done to safeguard the lives of 5,000 Americans living there and not necessarily to restore democracy. The White House has said that no intervention is imminent, but that military force remains an option. Meanwhile, Pentagon sources confirmed that 400 U.S. Marines had trained recently for a rescue mission at an island in the Bahamas. I'm Suni Khaled in Washington.
PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat has dedicated the building site for a 192-unit apartment building today near Gaza City. He thanked President Bill Clinton for the nearly $7 million the United States has contributed to the Palestinians to build homes. The American administrator for the U.S. Agency for International Development and the U.S. ambassador to Israel attended the ceremony. The Palestinian Housing Council says this is the first evidence of donor countries' contribution to the development of Palestinian infrastructure and economy. The apartment building is called Dignity Towers. It is the first of several projects the United States plans to finance in the Palestinian territories. Employees of American Ballet Theatre are leaving their union, the American Guild of Musical Artists. The decision affects dancers, choreographers, stage managers, and stage directors. The ballet company's decision to leave could have ramifications for other ballet and opera companies nationwide. Kim Kokage reports.
In what's believed to be an unprecedented move, the American Ballet Theatre has voted to sever ties to its labor union. The American Guild of Musical Artists, or AGMA, is a comparatively small union, but its membership includes some of the nation's most prominent dance and opera companies. ABT's departure is expected to have a significant impact on AGMA's ability to represent other artists. Dissatisfaction with AGMA has been growing over the past few years as severe financial problems forced companies to lay off dancers and cancel seasons and tours. Other dance companies, union and non-union, have been waiting for the ABT vote. They could decide to leave AGMA and join a new union, the Independent Artists of America, which is being formed by ABT artists. For National Public Radio, I'm Kim Kokich.
On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow gained 35 points to end at 3,739. Advances led declines by a margin of nearly 3-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Macy's has given up its bid to stay independent today and has set up a tentative agreement to merge with rival Federated Department Stores. The companies say when a definite merger plan is reached, they will file a joint reorganization plan for Macy, which is currently in bankruptcy protection. Macy had hoped to return to public ownership under its current management. The merger would create a firm that has stores like Bloomingdale's, Burdine's, Lazarus, and Bullock's, as well as Macy's. The government says retail sales were up 0.6% in June after 6 months of decline. Nina Teicholz reports.
The 0.6% rebound in sales by U.S. retailers in June was broad-based, with more sales reported in gas, clothing, and seasonal products such as garden items and building materials. The biggest boost, though, came in car sales, which climbed 1.3% after falling in May due to a temporary shortage of popular car models. Economist Roger Brinner predicts such healthy retail spending won't last.
It's too early for the interest rate increases of the winter and spring to really hit the economy. So the numbers that we have seen on retail sales and in other reports on housing of a fairly strong household spending pattern aren't giving us evidence yet of the burden of higher interest rates.
Analysts believe rising interest rates will eventually cut into consumer spending, since borrowing money is now more expensive and because people will no longer be able to save money on refinancing their houses as they did when interest rates were lower. For National Public Radio, this is Nina Teicholz reporting.
There's word of some big job cuts coming at Pepsi. The Wall Street Journal reports the firm plans to eliminate up to 20% of the 6,000 administrative jobs in the domestic soft drink division. The paper says the move stems from increased competition in soft drink markets, and the cuts will reportedly take place throughout the summer at various Pepsi locations. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with part two of our interview with Nelson Peery. He's written a new memoir called Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. In the first part of our show, he told us about the time he spent as a hobo during the Depression. He enlisted during World War II and served in the all-black 93rd Infantry Division of the Segregated Army. He wanted to fight to preserve justice abroad, even though he knew that as a black man, he couldn't hope for much justice at home. Did you ever feel when you joined the army that you were part of a military that was fighting to preserve a way of life that you were fighting to change?
Yes, that was a very clear, that was very obvious thing that the military was the mainstay of American reaction. There's no question about that. But at the same time, the military had to fight the worst threat to human freedom, and especially to the freedom of the colored peoples of the earth. That is to say, Hitler Germany. That the army had to fight them, despite the fact that huge sections of the officer corps had no argument with what Germany was trying to do. And so it was a very contradictory thing. And of course, the book, I think, shows as clearly as can be shown the terrible position that the black enlisted men were forced into in this segregated, Jim Crowed, Southern-led army.
What was the work that you had to do compared to what your white counterpart had to do?
Well, first of all, just as simply as infantrymen in the United States, we all did about the same thing, right? We trained and we went to the rifle range and we walked endless miles and our tasks were about the same as the tasks of the white soldiers as long as we were in the United States. But when we got overseas, it was a completely different situation. And that is to say that the Army did not want to commit black soldiers to combat. And the reason for it is a very simple one, that they learned in World War I that they could not expect these black soldiers to go overseas, fight and die for a freedom that they never had, and then come back home and be compelled to go back to building levees, picking cotton, and doing the drudgery of America. So therefore, the only way to guarantee that the blacks would return to second-class citizenship was to guarantee that they were second-class soldiers. And this was what we were primarily fighting against.
In what way were you kept as second-class soldiers? What was second-class about your position?
Well, first of all, in relation to the white officers, I would say that the Army, when I went into the Army, the Army still had this position that the best officers for a black organization is Southern whites. That the Southern whites, in quotes, knows the Negro better. Mm-hmm. And what happened, really, is that the black organizations were fiefdoms for these white officers. They had servants. They were waited on hand and foot. They demanded a discipline from the black troops that was never expected from the white troops. And it was, and of course, along with it, the terrible segregation of the black soldiers. For example, I was in the 369th Infantry of the 93rd Division, and we were stationed originally at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. There was absolutely no recreation at that post. That post was approximately 60 miles from the nearest town, whether it be Nogales or Phoenix or Bisbee. We were about 60 miles and no way to get into these towns. And when we could get into them, the segregation was such that we immediately got into fights and were barred from coming into these towns. And we had, as far as the USO was concerned, the USO never came near the black troops. Only towards the end of the war they began doing it. But But in 1942, 1943 period, 1941, there was the generals absolutely were appalled at the idea of white women dancing to entertain black soldiers. So therefore, we didn't get any entertainment. I mean, this kind of segregation, and let alone the fact that except for when we went to Mexico, there was no way for us to have recreation. And got into terrible fights in Phoenix, you know, with, especially with the white soldiers for the 8th Air Force. And so it was a very difficult time for us. And yet I think that the reality was that it was not qualitatively different from what we are known as civilians.
Did you ever try to rebel?
There wasn't any sense of rebellion in the sense of the word of overthrowing something. But we were constantly being pulled into fights. And these fights in the beginning were just fights between soldiers, like between the, I mean, our relations with the 8th Air Force was notorious. And we fought them everywhere we went, in Bisbee and Phoenix and in Nogales. We got into fights with the 8th Air Force. When we went to Louisiana, there was some struggle against the white civilians. But the main thing of it was a general wave in 1943 when we were in Louisiana, the general wave of anti-black violence that was everywhere, not just in the not just in Louisiana and against the black soldiers. I mean, there was like the riot in Beaumont and Detroit. And when I say riot, I know that most of the people who will hear this program think in terms of blacks uprising. That's not what riots were in the 1940s or the 1930s or 1920s. When you said riot, you meant white mobs invading the black community, burning the homes, killing the people, and with the police assisting them, of course. So we had this terrible riot in Beaumont, Texas, and the even worse riot in Detroit. And then, of course, other riots of a smaller dimension were everywhere else, Los Angeles, St. Louis, and so forth and so on. And it was this general frustration of being a armed soldier and living in a situation where these mobs were killing blacks, and we weren't able to come to their assistance because we couldn't get there. And this kind of frustration, you know, sometimes boiled up to the point where people began taking pot shots at other people. But it wasn't terribly widespread, although we were very close. We were prepared for a fight. Like, for example,
what did you do to prepare, and what were you expecting?
Well, first of all, by the time we left Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and we had already gotten a committee of people together in the three regiments of my division, the 25th Infantry, the 368th, and 369th. Only about 20 people in each of these regiments. But we met from time to time to discuss what we would do if we were attacked by the Klan or if a riot occurred in either Manny, Louisiana, or DeRidder, because these areas were close enough for us to get to. And so by the time we got to Louisiana, of course, the entire division was armed, I mean, with ammunition, that we expected the very worst when we got to Louisiana. And so we were prepared. And we kept our ammunition, buried it when we got to a bivouac area, dug it up when we left, but we were prepared to fight if the fight came down. Now, on the other hand, I should say that it's clear now that the secret services of the Army, that is to say the G2 department, and the counterintelligence corps, they operated amongst the police and the Klan and amongst the more reactionary sections of the peoples in Louisiana, warning them against any provocation against our division. Because they understood that if 18,000 soldiers, the number of men in my division, were pulled into some kind of action, you're not going to be dealing with an uprising, right? You're going to be dealing with a civil war. And so what happened, like in Camp Stewart, Georgia, where a group of white men surrounded three soldiers and demanded that they say yes, sir, to them. And these soldiers said, we're not going to do it. And this mob shot those three soldiers to death. Now, if that would have been, it happened around with our division, we would have undoubtedly been pulled into a quite broadly based action. And so the G2 department, I think, went out of its way to guarantee that this didn't happen by warning the Klan to stay away from us. Like in Camp Shelby, the Klan attacked the black troops and killed several of them. And other parts of Mississippi, there was attacks against black soldiers. But it was always an attack of a very, you know, of a very large group of whites against a very small group of black soldiers. Well, we were not a small group, and we were armed. So, and the Klan, of course, and the rest of these fascists were a bunch of cowards. And if they were, you know, one by one, one-on-one, they wouldn't fight, right? They'd pull back. So we didn't get involved in directly, although we were at the edge of fighting, at the edge of uprisings, and at the edge of intervening in these riots from the time we got to Louisiana until the time we left.
My guest is Nelson Peary, author of the new memoir, Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nelson Peary. So it sounds like when you were in the Army, you were probably even angrier about conditions for black people in America than you were when you were a civilian.
I think you saw it from a different point of view. You saw that you were part of the apparatus that was oppressing the blacks. I mean, the military police, there was part of the Army. And in back of the police forces everywhere stood the might of the United States Army. So, yes, we were more angry about it. And I think the other part of it is that people generally who are incapable of resistance find some other way to express themselves than through anger. But when you have a rifle and you have ammunition and you have organization, you're much more likely to become very much more angry very quickly.
Did you want to fight overseas?
I kind of did. I think there was a whole grouping of us in the division that felt that somehow or another we would have a better hand, so to speak, if we had on our shirt this combat infantry badge and these battle stars, and we'd come back and say, look, I fought for this country, and I'm going to take it. It's mine. And I think that a number of us felt that we had to do this in order to achieve this. I think the majority of the men in the division felt that there was absolutely nothing for them to fight for. And the morale in our division, of course, according to Army standards, was very, very low.
But you were sent overseas. Where were you sent?
We were all sent overseas in the beginning of 1943. And we campaigned through the Solomon Islands and in part of New Guinea, Finchhaven, Zanzibar, Hollandia, and one of our regiments fought in Bougainville, and we did mopping up action in some of the other Solomon Islands and in the Dutch East Indies. But by and large, our division wasn't committed to major independent operations because on the one hand, that it's true that the morale was quite low, and the soldiers didn't see any reason to lay down their lives. You know, for an infantryman, morale means that you're prepared to lay down your life for a national purpose. And without this concept, you cannot be a good soldier. You cannot be a good infantry soldier. And there was very few of the men in the 93rd Division that felt that, in fact, that what they were to lay down their lives for the likes of Senator Bilbo and Eastland and this gang, and for the Jim Crow laws and for the lynch mob and for the rule of segregation, that wasn't something to die for.
Would you have been willing to lay down your life?
That's a hard question to answer. I tried very hard not to get in a situation where I had to do so. But at the same time, I think that when you go into combat, you don't think about whether you want to lay down your life for a specific purpose.
You just think of surviving, right?
Yeah, somebody's trying to kill you, and you're trying to protect yourself and protect your buddies. And so you lose all sense of this under fire. However, around the campfires, before and after battle, you spend most of your time talking about this sort of thing.
I get the impression from your book that after being in battle, you started to feel like you were in danger of dehumanizing the Japanese in the same way that you felt whites had dehumanized blacks.
Yes, that's true. I mean, when you call somebody that you're killing, if you'll excuse me, a Jap bastard. Now, these are the same race of people, these young women that gave me the bushel of peas and hoped that I had good luck and helped me get out of this slave camp I was in, right? This is the same nationality. But you call him that name as you're killing this man. You know that what you're doing is setting him outside the human race. And you suddenly see that every white that called you a nigger and a black bastard, that they were setting you outside the human race so they could kill you without fear of retribution, either here or in the hereafter, right? And suddenly I realized in a real sense of the word, the oneness of humanity. And if I was going to fight the Japanese, I was going to fight them because their national effort was one that was in opposition to the well-being of the peoples of the earth, that they were the same fascists that the German army was, but in no way was I ever going to again be pulled into this kind of a setting, a human being outside of the human race that I did once in my life. It was a very, very traumatizing thing for me when I realized what I had done.
When you got home from the war, did you feel that black veterans were treated any differently than white veterans were? Did you feel like you got what you were supposed to from the GI Bill, for instance?
What happened in 1919 with the coming home of World War I veterans, what they call the Red Summer, this summer of lynchings and beatings and burnings and brutality, to force them back to the plantations, back to keep picking cotton, back to building levees. They did to a less extent after World War II. Like, the best example I can give to you is Sergeant Woodward, who was on his way back home south on the bus. And when they got to the Mason-Dixon line, he was ordered to go to the back of the bus. He said, "I was in the front lines. I'm not going to the back of the bus." And when the cops got him, they beat him senseless and gouged his eyes out. Even Truman had to say, this can't go on. Mm-hmm. And Truman was for segregation. Whether he did away with it in the Army or not, he was committed to segregation. But at any rate, there was all kinds of lynchings and brutalities and police killings. I mean, even people like General Omar Bradley, who was supposed to be the great GI general, he was such a militant segregationist, it wasn't funny. And at the end of the war, when he was head of the Army, he enforced to the letter every bit of segregation in the veterans' hospitals and in the Army that he could possibly do. And he was one of the better generals. And so, yes, we were treated very badly at the end of the war, and it's one of the reasons that I completed my leftward motion, my leftward journey, I think, was to realize that there was no way that we could get through this thing in a simple and peaceful manner.
My guest is Nelson Peary, author of the new memoir Black Fire. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Refugees from Rwanda are flooding across the border to Zaire. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. I'll talk with United Nations relief worker in Goma in Zaire. He describes the Hutu refugees coming across the border walking in family groups. In other stories, Alan Tomlinson reports from Haiti on human rights abuses in that country, especially rape. I'll talk with a man selling the grass from Giants Stadium, where the World Cup soccer play is now over. Also in Japan, the people who govern sumo wrestling there have declared it illegal to use silicon implants on the top of your head to make the height requirement for sumo wrestling.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Nelson Peary. His new memoir, Black Fire, is about being a hobo during the Depression and serving in the segregated army during World War II. Your memoir, Black Fire, ends after you come home from the military. And on the last page, you write that you decided you would use the GI Bill of Rights and learn to fight another way. Did you?
Well, I went to the University of Minnesota for a year and a half. And by the end of that year and a half, the McCarthy period had really set in, and I became convinced that I couldn't be a serious revolutionary and a professional at the same time. So I quit school and learned the bricklayer's trade and became a bricklayer and maintained myself as a revolutionary over these years.
When you say revolutionary, what do you mean?
I mean to say of participating in the organized revolutionary movement for about 10 years. I was a member of the Communist Party, and I was thrown out of that in 1954, really. And from then on, I participated in various other organizations. Right now, I'm one of the national officers of the National Organizing Committee that is committed to change in the United States based upon robotics, based upon the fact that the capitalist system can no longer survive. It can't maintain itself with the new means of production. So I've always been in revolutionary work ever since I was actually 16 or 17 years old, and have continued. Sometimes I had to change how and what I was doing, but I maintained myself in this. I might say just finally that when we talk about a revolutionary, we're not talking about throwing gasoline bombs or, shouting in the middle of the street. We're talking about trying to find out what are the objective, if I can say so, and human factors that are involved in change. And when you see these factors available, how do you go about working with them? Like, again, as I want to refer to the question of the economic revolution that's taking place in the United States, it's bound to be followed by a social reorganization or a social revolution. The role of the revolutionary today is to guarantee that the poor people, the downtrodden, come out as the rulers of America.
How do you make a living now?
How do I
make a living now?
Oh, I'm 71 years old now, and I'm retired. And hopefully the book will help me pull the strings together. But I live on my Social Security, which isn't very much, as you can imagine.
You wrote this book many years ago and then picked it up and started editing it or rewriting it?
Well, I rewrote it some. Of course, when I first wrote it, I was only about 24 years old, and it was a very much of an ideological statement. And, of course, there was no way to get it published during the McCarthy period. So I just set it aside and basically forgot about it until about a year ago when I found it and reread it and handed it to my wife, and she reread it, she read it, first time she'd seen it. And we decided, hey, I should take a little time off and try to rewrite this, which I did. And I was really surprised when I sent it into the new press, and they accepted it right away.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your story with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you much.
Nelson Peary's new memoir, Black Fire, is published by the New Press. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed today's show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, space is the place. Next Wednesday is the 25th anniversary of the first moonwalk. We'll hear from astronaut Alan Shepard, and Chuck Yeager will tell us how he first broke the sound barrier. Also, a comet is about to crash into Jupiter. We'll talk to David Levy, a member of the team that discovered the comet. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.